This week on the Picture House podcast, we were very lucky to be joined by national treasure Jim Broadbent, who stars as Kempton Bunton in The Duke, director Roger Michell's last feature. And the two scriptwriters, Richard Bean, One Man, Two Governors, and Clive Coleman, Spitting Image. We really hope you enjoy both chats covering all angles of this quintessentially British caper.
Hi, Jim. Hi.
Hi, Felicity.
I absolutely loved the film. Can you tell us about how you got to know and love the extraordinary Kempton Bunton?
I was sent the script. I heard there was a good, wonderful script coming my way. And so by the time it arrived, I'd been given the nod that it was a great script. So I read it with slight trepidation. I think, can it be that good? And I loved it. I absolutely loved it from the word go. And I got terribly excited. I thought, this is a fantastic script, beautifully written, and a great part. And a story that I didn't know, which is a fantastical story, which wouldn't be believed if it wasn't true, if you see what I mean. And I thought, this is wonderful. And then Roger is attached, so that's fantastic, because he was my favourite director, and it all developed from there. And then we got Helen on board.
How did you work with Roger to develop the character? Did he have a very definite idea of what he wanted?
I think we'd both read the script, and it was clear from the script what was wanted, and it was and the fact that I was doing it defines an awful lot of what the character's like. Well, certainly defines what he looks like. But the way the character developed was on the page. Really, it's a lovely piece of writing. So we didn't have to discuss it and work out and what's it about. It was explicit, really.
And I wonder if that was the case with Dorothy as well, because Helen Mirren plays her with such wonderful empathy, and she is genuinely distressed by her husband's behaviour. You know, that's one of the sort of less comedic elements, even though she's very, very funny and has some great lines. And I wondered about that sort of palpable energy. Was that there on the page as well, or was that something that you sought to create?
I think the family relationships were all the group of the family, those scenes with the family, were all beautifully written. So and her position in Dorothy's position in the family is clear from the writing, and then having Helen playing her, and Helen has her own wonderful presence, which was reflected in Dorothy, and the relationship of the rest of us to Dorothy and to Helen was perfectly matched, really, because we were all, you know, slightly in awe of Helen. So that was, all the boys in the family, including Kempton, are certainly in awe of Dorothy as well. So it's a, and that was, that energy came from through very naturally and easily.
The story may be 60 years old, but it certainly hasn't lost any of its relevance. You know, an out-of-touch government, one wily individual bucking the system. My feeling was that we really need more of these more down-to-earth heroes. And like you say, it's a true story. What are your hopes for where the film's message lands?
I hope a lot of people go to see it and get the feeling, yes, there are good things that happen in the world. It's not all bleak and deceit and people trying to get one over each other and undermining each other. There is a generosity that is inherent in the human psyche, which is there all the time and it isn't recognized enough. But it's certainly, that is a big thing about being human, is that the fact that we do share the world, and most of the time we share it in a very benevolent and generous way, but that gets overlooked with some of the nastier stories that seem to preoccupy us. But I think goodness is there in all of us and should be appreciated and relished and enjoyed and nurtured.
And celebrated. And I felt this film was so of the cinema, because that is where we commune to celebrate these extraordinary champions and stories. And I wondered, had you have a chance to see it in the cinema and connect?
I saw the premiere last night on the big screen with a big crowd, and that went terribly well, and it was really exciting. And the laughs come, you know, it's the perfect thing. You know, the laughter, you don't get a good comedy without there being something at stake, and there's certainly a lot at stake in this film and in this story, and a lot of laughs all coming from the right place, not gratuitous. They're good laughs that mean you're following the story and enjoying it and enjoying the characters, and I think I think audiences will warm to it in a wonderful way. I hope so, because I'm proud of it, and I know Roger was very proud of it, and it's, I also love it as this being a tribute to Roger and a way we can celebrate what a wonderful film director he was.
Absolutely. And this was your second film with him, I believe. I mean, and I'm very fond of his oeuvre as well. I loved The Mother and Enduring Love and obviously Notting Hill. And yeah, I think this is a very fitting final tribute to him. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's the loss is immense, but because everyone who worked with him in theatre and film, either backstage, behind the camera, in front of the camera, on stage, everyone just wanted to work with him again, you know, because he was the perfect director who was cared about what he was doing, chose carefully what he wanted to do, and was brilliant at casting. And had, and I mean, in The Duke, every single tiny part is perfectly cast. And that was people who come in for two lines, one line, you believe them instantly. There's nothing questionable about it at all. And he was a lovely director. And I think it is a loss, but it is immeasurable.
Yeah. And such a shame he didn't get to see the film in cinema, but wonderful that he saw it completed.
Yeah, and he saw it in Venice, not with the English speaking home crowd that he was looking forward to. That, you know, he saw it in Telluride, which is I think went very well. But I think he would have loved to have been here last night to see the premiere in front of his English Brit peers.
Yeah. And there is something so quintessentially English about it. So I know what you mean. That is a shame, because even though it's set in the 60s, it's actually a very original 60s caper as opposed to a period piece. And I thought he did that brilliantly. You know, it was very authentic. Were you aware of that during the filming? Was that part of the fun, like that lovely footage of you?
Part of the fun was recognizing that in the Northeast in 1961, you might as well be in 1954. It was a good half decade behind. It wasn't swinging London. We didn't have wasn't the swinging 60s in Newcastle at that time. You know, it was a different degree of post-war poverty there, I think. And Roger was keen to find that particular element as well.
Yes, it was very well balanced between the comedic and the darker, more important in a way. Not comedy isn't important, but the sort of sub story as well, and also dealing with grief. I thought that was very moving.
There's so many elements to the story, you know, which because it's a real story, they're justified in being there, and then the fact that he was a playwright. Templeton was an unproduced playwright. You wouldn't drop that into a fictional story. It'd be sort of, why? You know, but it's there, and he was, and it just makes it all more interesting. And then that leads away into investigating the grief. You know, it's a lovely, the real story is wonderful, and I think Richard and Clive, the writers, made absolutely the most of it. It's terrific.
I couldn't agree more. I absolutely, I was just very cross that I'd never heard of him before.
Yeah, well, you do now.
Exactly. I thought, why not know Tempton Fanton? He's a hero.
Yeah. Well, it's down to his family presenting it to Nicky Bentham and saying, we've got this family story. Here you are. And she made the most of it.
Yes, and his grandson was very helpful, I understand.
Yeah, he presented it, I think. It was him who came up with the idea.
And was he able to tell you about Kempton and give you some tips?
I didn't meet him, I think. Not beforehand, no, but I think the others had met him. But the family came, a lot of the family came last night and loved it and appreciated it. I'd said to some journalists that I thought Kempton would have glowed if he had been there last night. And I mentioned this to the family and they said, oh, absolutely. He would have been over the moon, having had all these plays not published. Here he was on the big screen in London's glittering West End. And there he'd have been absolutely over the moon with excitement.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
That's nice that the family appreciated it and they're behind it. They like they like what we've done, even if it's not particularly. I mean, I'm probably nothing like Kempton, really. But
I don't know. I thought the picture at the end, I thought was very.
Well, there's a bit of that, yeah.
Very similar, but yes, I can imagine someone now taking up the girl on the bike, and that would really make his legacy complete, wouldn't it?
That would, wouldn't it?
Jim Broadbent, thank you so much for joining us on the Picture House podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure and good luck with this magnificent film. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your support. Thank you.
Richard and Clive, welcome to the Picture House podcast. You are the writers of the wonderful The Duke. It's been so warmly received, and I know that you had your premiere earlier this week. How was that for you both?
Smashing.
Brilliant.
Champion.
In a slightly immature way.
Yeah.
Unbelievably fantastic. You know, I mean, it's something we neither of us have quite experienced.
Yeah. What should we be? Awesome, I think, is.
Wicked.
Sick.
It was well bad. Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah. Well bad.
Well sick.
Yeah. So tell me, because you're both very well known for your theatre. Richard, you wrote One Man, Two Governors, and Clive, you're Spitting Image writing, and I know that you wrote What Young Marks together, but is this your first cinematic screenplay, and why cinema over theatre in this case? Richard, shall I address that to you first?
Yeah, this is our first film that's been produced together, writing together. Yeah, well, Pathé came to me offering me this story, and I said, well, I don't write film on my own, I write with Clive, and so we were both on board to do this. But Clive and I first worked together writing as a team in about 1992, where we did a sketch show for BBC Radio called Control Group 6. It was a kind of Monty Python teams, you know, there was me, Clive, Andy Clifford, Colin Swash was the producer and also a writer. So it was that kind of sketch show kind of thing. So that was the first time we worked together. But since then we worked on, well, you know about Young Marks, you've spotted that. But before Young Marks, we worked together on a play called Great Britain, which was on at the National with, what was the lead in it, Clive?
Billy Piper
played the lead, and it was transferred to the West End with Lucy Punch playing the lead. It's about phone hacking, but we worked together on that. But Clive was still at the BBC, so I don't think you'd better talk about that, Clive. Why didn't your name? Name in lights?
Well, because we got the gig to write it, and we went off and started writing it, and I was covering phone hacking as a story as the BBC legal correspondent. And so I thought, after, you know, we've been going for a few months, I thought, but I'm just going to have a chat with the head of news and just check this is okay. And they said, don't put your name on it, because I was reporting on it at the time, that was obviously deemed to be too, and it was a very, very, very hot story, if you remember back then. And so I sadly had to, I was credited as the story consultant, and I had to take my name off it as a writer. But
and that I got all the royalties.
We're talking about stories, though. I mean, what I was most surprised about with Kempton Banton is that I didn't know about him, and I would have thought that he would have. That is quite a massive story. It's the only theft in the National's 150-year. History, and it could, he could have never given the picture back, and it could have never come to anything. So Clive, tell me about, I think it's Nikki Bentham, wasn't it? She was approached by the family and then, you know, and taking it on board.
It's, it's like every family's got a great story, but that family story is the great story to end all family great stories. And Nikki gets lots and lots of emails, but she got an email from Chris Bunton, who's the great nephew, I think, of Kempton.
I think his great nephew is kind of Jackie's nephew, so that makes him great nephew, I think.
Great nephew, yeah. And with this story, and Nikki was intrigued and then met him. And, you know, this was a huge story in the day. Back in the day, I mean, it was so big that it gets into a James Bond film. That's how big a story it was in the press. And, you know, the trial at the Old Bailey was front page news. But everyone seems to have forgotten about it. And, you know, the more we looked into it, it was kind of jaw-droppingly kind of just brilliant at every turn. I mean, everything about the story is incredible. Even the fact that the barrister was, you know, Jeremy Hutchinson QC was married to Dame Peggy Ashcroft.
Yeah.
Even the little details were fantastic and the big details were amazing.
One of the details I really enjoyed was that the painting isn't actually very good.
One of the guys who came along on the premiere, pal of mine, Ansel Kroot, who is, a well-known fine artist and has taught at the National Gallery. And I asked him to write a couple of sentences in kind of art jargon to help us with the script. That's why you got an invite, as well as being a very good friend of mine. He loves the painting, thinks it's really very, very good. And I remember having an argument in the taxi with him. He said, but that shiny forehead, I mean, if you've seen it, it's just like oil slapped on and the light catches it. And Ansel will disagree. And he knows more than I. So.
Fair enough.
Actually, interestingly, it didn't really make the final cut. But one of Hutchinson's lines of attack in defending Kempton Banton was that the painting might not even have been by Goya and might have been a kind of worthless little fake, in which case he was stealing something of no value at all. It was a bit of a kind of smokescreen type defence. It was just raising a lot of dust. But he really got the, I think it was a former head of the Royal Academy, you know, he did a very, very effective cross-examination. We had that all in the original script, but, you know, for time, that didn't survive. But
yes, it was a very efficient film, actually, isn't it? It's really pacey and gutsy. And Jim Broadbent said that was all in the script. It was all there. He was very complimentary about how fabulous the script was and that there was almost no need for discussion, you know, with Roger Michell about how he said it was all on the page. I imagine you two are incredibly simpatico now with having worked with each other for so long. Is that right?
Well, first of all, it's just very nice that Jim was able to read my handwriting on those notes that I slipped into his pocket. So that's a relief. No, we have slipped into a way of working where I think
we've got a way of working now, haven't we? And we have little, let's call them tools. We argue about whether a line's good or is working. But we have little rules. I might say, well, I'm not going to die on a hill for it. And so Clive gets his way if I say I'm not going to die on a hill for it. And Clive's got his way of saying things like, well, if Richard Bean thinks it's funny and has told me that 15 times, then who am I to argue? It's that we have ways of working, don't we?
Yeah.
But we have a lot of fun as well. We break for a game of table tennis and do a bit of brambling. And what else do we do? Cook.
Yeah. Your own jumpers.
Clive always turns up with loads of food and does a lot of cooking.
Yeah, no, I definitely feel that there is an energy there of collaboration that's way beyond just two people meeting. There's such a lovely grace to the humour and the depth of it. I mean, the story is very much around grief as well. And can you talk to me about involving Marion as a character? Obviously, she doesn't appear on screen, but she's very present.
Yeah, well, in Kempton Bunton's plays, and we've got access to about six of his plays, and one of them was all about a girl who, on a bicycle, who is knocked over by a bus and dies. And I mean, it's not much of a metaphor, given that Kempton's own child died in a cycling accident, not by a bus. She died going downhill in the country. I just came off her bike with nobody else was involved. But that seemed to us to be a deep vein of dysfunction within the family. And we kind of, because obviously Dorothy deals with the death differently from Kempton. Kempton's all, oh, I'm going to write about this, and my daughter died, and he's typing and whatever. And Dorothy is trying to repress it. She just puts a lid on the dustbin of grief and tries to keep the dustbin lid closed. And that's what's tearing the family apart. So it was there, and I think it enriches all of the actions of every character, actually. Especially, of course, Jackie, who is, you know, motivated to do whatever he's motivated to do, partly because of the dysfunction in his family.
I agree. Yes, it was very gracefully handled, I thought, as well. You know, because of that time, grief wasn't much spoken about, was it? And so people found their ways of processing. And also, I thought it was very interesting how the look of the film was such great fun 60s style graphics and things, but also Newcastle, as Jim Broadbent kindly pointed out to me, was not swinging in the 60s. So Clive, I wonder if you could tell me about that juxtaposition. Was that something that you were aware of while you were writing the script?
The Newcastle was sort of a long way from Petticoat Lane kind of thing.
I think so, yeah, because the look of the film is a very 60s caper. It's delicious to look at, you know.
I think there's always that, people always think, oh, 19, let's say, what was this, 61. So fashion terms, it's not going to be 1961. It's going to be 1951.
Yeah.
Because everyone's always 10 years behind. Carnaby Street may not be 10 years behind, but everybody else is always 10 years behind. So,
yeah, you know, I mean, no, I agree with you. I think we had always kind of mentally, we were living in the 1950s rather than the swinging 60s. Because the painting was stolen in reality in August 1961, and then it was returned in 1965. The trial was in 65. So by the time the trial took place in London, the 60s had started to swing a bit. But we've compressed everything down into sort of a 6-month period. And we just, I think it felt like, post-austerity Britain really is where it's set, I think. You know, post-war austerity Britain is where it feels to me like we always kind of set it, rather than, the birth of the Beatles.
Yeah. And I just want to talk about Roger Michell as well. Obviously, it's such a shame that he couldn't have been there on Monday for the premiere, because it's such a quintessentially British film. Can you tell me about working with him? Was he completely on board with the script? Did he get where you were coming from?
You know, he was first and foremost, he was just a brilliant director. And the way he has, the little touches and the way he's painted this film and the direction is just sublime, really, and we're really lucky to have had him. And it is, as you say, it's a tragedy that he didn't get to see the film released. But the first meeting we had with him, he sat down and said, was in his offices in North London. He said, great script, guys. And we thought, oh, wow, right, this would be a short meeting. And then he said, but story starts 30 pages too late. And so that, and we'd written a lot of scenes, about Kempton in his community and great character stuff. But Roger's directorial eye, could tell that, as great as they were for text, he didn't really need them. So we had to, as what's the phrase, William Faulkner, murder our darlings.
Slaughter your babies.
Yeah. Get rid of a lot of stuff from the early part. And he wanted more energy in that early part of the film, and he was absolutely right.
Bang on right. And it was Roger who moved the opening scene to the courtroom. It obviously in the end it is the shooting script, but it was Roger's idea to bring the charges, to open the film with the charges.
Yeah, which was a great piece of directing nous and
yes, and I completely agree, because I wondered why he started where he did, and I loved the efficiency of his filmmaking in general. He is a very sharp storyteller.
Yeah.
And so this is a very fitting tribute to him, definitely. And just finally, when you're writing a script like this, do you have a dream team in mind, like Jim Broadbent and Helen Mirren, to play your amazing characters?
Well, for this story, we couldn't think of anybody else but Jim. Absolutely. We couldn't think of another British actor that could do it. And apologies to any British actors out there who think they could have done it. We weren't thinking of you. We're just talking about Jim all the time, weren't we, whilst writing it, before he'd even been offered it.
Once you've got that so firmly in your mind, you know, it really helps the writing, because, you know, you know, he's just a supreme actor who can do, I mean, he has to pull off this character that's, you know, kind of an idiot, but he's also got a lot of learning, and he's got belief. He really, on the basis of no evidence whatsoever, that he can change the world, change society, make life a better experience for people, you know, sense of social justice, and pull all of that off with, you know, his sort of infuriating sort of ability to delude himself and all that sort of stuff. And it's a subtle trick to be able to do all that, and, you know, knows his Shakespeare, knows his Chekhov and all that sort of stuff. And you know, we couldn't really think of anyone else who could pull that off, and thank goodness we got Jim Broadbent.
And yes, he said he loved the script from the minute he read it. And what about Helen Mirren? I thought she played Dorothy with such empathy. She was the perfect yin to the yang.
Yeah, I mean, she's a brilliant actress, isn't she? I mean, we think of Helen Mirren as being pretty sexy, pretty direct, a protagonist. But she may be those things, but the main thing she is an actor. So, you know, if she can put the clothes on of a beaten down cleaning woman, then she does it. It's just acting.
She does, yes.
Well. We were absolutely thrilled when she said yes, you know.
Completely.
Yeah, I mean, coming off, you know, the Queen and Catherine the Great, Dorothy Bunton didn't seem like the obvious next role for her.
But she is a queen. She is a matriarch. She is,
I think that's what appealed to her. That was, you know, she hadn't played a part like that for a very, very long time. I don't think she. I stand corrected if she has. But, you know, she. I think it was just that change of pace, something different, and a different challenge for her. And of course, she was completely fantastic. Really worked so hard on. I think she had lessons in loo cleaning, you know. Yeah, they had to find.
God, I wish I needed those.
Yeah. But I think there is someone who can teach loo cleaning, you know, in the style of the late 50s and early 60s.
Got a whistle in a Geordie accent.
That is brilliant. And just finally, you know, a hero for our times, even though it's 60 years old, we're still dealing with out of touch governments, one-off wily individuals who come along like Kempton Bunton. You know, where do you hope the message for this film will land?
Well, there's a humanity to Kempton Bunton, isn't there? He knows he's part of a community and part of a collective species, and there are some people going around today who seem to have forgotten that, so maybe they can learn from this.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's you know, it comes out at a time when we've arguably never been more, you know, divided and riven, you know, and less inclined to listen to the other people's point of view and to, you know, see humanity as a kind of common project. And, you know, all those things sound like whopping great cliches, and they are to a degree, but, you know, that is a simple message, and it's, you know, if people can take something away from it, it's the power of that message.
Exactly. I completely agree. I was in bits at Jerusalem at the end. I just thought it was the perfect song to finish the whole thing, you know. And was that a script judgment in that, or was that a Roger Michell?
That was a script. No, that was a script judgment.
It was a script one, but there were a lot of arguments about it, weren't there? It's touching on cliche, having Jerusalem at the end. I remember Pathé meeting. Do we really need to do Jerusalem? And you and I say okay. Yes. I think
I've forgotten that.
Well, I'm very pleased that you did. So, Richard Bean and Clive Coleman, thank you so much for joining me today on the Picture House podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you both, and thank you so much for bringing us the Duke.
Thank you.
Thank you.